Welcome to Inside Medical Malpractice. This subject fascinates everyone everywhere because it affects everyone everywhere. My name is Chris Rokosch. I'm a registered nurse, legal consultant and educator, and the president of Connect Medical Legal Experts. Medical malpractice affects patients, families, nurses, doctors, midwives, healthcare institutions, the associations that define medical standards, lawyers, and the general public. Each month, we'll be looking at the malpractice issues from different perspectives, featuring honest, candid, insightful interviews by people and professionals with a wealth of information to share. Thanks for spending time with me today. Now let's dive into this fascinating subject. I'm here today with Paul Cahill, a plaintiff's lawyer from the firm of Will Davidson in Toronto. After receiving his BA from Queen's University in 2001 and his LLB from the University of Ottawa in 2004, Paul was called to the bar in 2005. He's been a partner with the Toronto office of Will Davidson since 2011. He helps seriously injured people obtain compensation for their losses, whether it's medical malpractice, car accidents, slip and falls, product failures, and he assists people with first-party insurance claim for disability benefits. Paul successfully litigated both jury and non-jury cases in the Superior Court of Justice and appeared before the Divisional Court and the Court of Appeal. Welcome, Paul.
Hi.
How are you? I'm really good. I'm so glad to have you here. We're not going to dwell on this at all, but I think it's maybe worth mentioning that we're recording this on April 3rd, 2020. What is in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. Paul's at his home office in Toronto. I'm in Calgary, alone in a room at When Sparks Fly Production Studios. The producer, Steve, is in another room recording Paul by telephone. And I think we'll all have some specific memories from this time, and this will certainly be one of mine. How are you holding up, Paul?
I'm doing well. Like we were chatting earlier, just trying to stay productive and keep my spirits up and, looking forward to seeing this pandemic end, all of us.
Yeah, aren't we all? Aren't we all? Well said. Well, in prepping for this meeting or this podcast, I watched a 90-second video on your website called Meet Paul Cahill, which probably makes your... it's like, oh, no, not the video. But I've known you professionally for some time through our work together as lawyer and expert, and we've spoke at multiple conferences together. And so I took a look at this just to learn more about you from your own perspective, how you would describe yourself. And I was really struck, I mean, some of the things you said, that this is a complicated, expensive, difficult, sad, tough area of law to work in, medical malpractice. But you get great satisfaction from achieving a result that gives your clients a sense of closure. And you have a lot of satisfaction in knowing that the work you've done over the years has resulted in positive outcomes, and that you believe that the best outcomes come from hard work and preparation. So two things about that. First of all, really well said. But the other thing that was so striking to me is those are probably some of the words that, knowing you only as well as I do, but I would use those same words to describe you as someone who can, with all respect and admiration, kind of sit quietly in the midst of complicated or adversarial conversations and then say the thing that needs to be said. And as someone like me who's chatty and does a lot of thinking on the outside, I've always really admired that about you.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. You're very welcome. It's a good video. So when I approached Paul a couple of months ago about potentially doing some podcasts, and this is such a wide open field with so many fascinating things to talk about, I think, the field of medical malpractice, I asked him what he would like to talk about, what he's passionate about, and what's, high on his radar right now. And Paul has the distinction of running three medical malpractice trials in the last 12 months. Is running the right word, Paul, when I say that, if I say you
yeah,
run?
Yeah, I think running, yeah, for sure.
Running a trial. Now, to many people listening, you might not quite get the significance of what I say when Paul ran three trials last year, But statistically, in the entire country of Canada, there's only about 60 medical malpractice trials a year, spread out between hundreds of lawyers or firms that say that their practice includes medical malpractice. So, first of all, it sounds like you had a busy year.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah. And we're going to talk lots more about that. But I think another really significant part of this is of those 60-ish malpractice cases that went to trial in 2018, only 8 of them resulted in a successful judgment or win for the plaintiff. And I understand that so far you're personally responsible for 2 and hopefully 3 of those wins in the past year. What do you have to say about yourself, Paul? I mean, that sounds great.
No, I mean, I'm very proud of the work that I put in the last year on these cases. And I can tell you that it's been a journey to develop, these cases to the point that they went to trial. And I was really over the moon excited that, 2 of them were successful and we're just waiting on the third one, which hopefully will be successful as well. And you're right, the statistics are daunting. Not a lot of, cases are successful when they do go to trial. And we know that these cases are hard fought and often plaintiffs face the choice of either abandoning the claim or going to trial without much option to settle somewhere in between. So, yeah, I mean, we can talk about the case in a little bit more detail, but certainly just on a high level, having done these trials in the last 12 months, certainly made me feel like I'm doing what I was meant to do in terms of litigation. I feel really comfortable doing these trials. They're hard and they're stressful, and we'll talk about that. But definitely, I felt like I was in the right place representing these people in court.
That's a powerful statement, because certainly, I can only imagine the stress of, the lengthy, you described it that it was a hard-fought case or a hard-fought battle to get where you did. So has it ever happened to you before that you had 3 trials in 1 year, medical malpractice trials?
No. And in fact, apart from these 3, I'd only had been involved in 2 other medical malpractice cases, both of which were successful, I'll say. So I have a pretty good track record for medical malpractice cases. Interesting, I don't tell a lot of people this, but I'll admit it to you. I've pretty much lost every other type of case I've tried, be it motor vehicle or slip and fall.
Really?
I actually have a pretty bad track record for non-medical malpractice cases. But I gained invaluable experience doing jury and non-jury non-medical malpractice trials over the last 15 years or so, which I think helps prepare me for, this increase or uptake in doing medical malpractice trials. But no, I surprisingly, I have a very good, probably a statistically higher than expected win rate for MedMal, but I have a pretty bad one for non-medical malpractice cases.
So what's the secret? I'm sure there's lawyers out there listening that's like, okay, what, Paul, what is the secret to winning every single one of your medical malpractice trials so far?
I don't know. I like to think it's me, but,
okay, we'll give you that.
Some of the cases I tried in the past, they were very difficult cases. Not to say that these medical malpractice cases aren't difficult, but there's just something, I'll call it a gut feeling that I have with these cases that I just know that they're going to be successful. And I feel it in when I'm looking at the evidence, when I'm talking to my experts, when I'm applying what I'd say a common sense perspective on these cases. Because I think, as we get involved in the medical aspects of the case, things can get quite complicated. But I always, try to look at the cases from a layperson, because it's ultimately a layperson who will decide the case, and whether it has sort of a ring of truth or a ring of justice, which is, they're just talking about the case casually, most people would conclude that there was negligence and that negligence caused harm to a patient. And if I have that sense, even what the defense experts may say or the defense counsel, I just kind of know that it should be a win for the plaintiff. And in all the cases that I've tried on medical malpractice, I always had that feeling that this was a case where justice would be done for the plaintiff.
That's really interesting to know, because not everybody trusts their gut, you know, or kind of trusts those instinctual feelings. It's easy to override them with logic or fear or facts or arguments. And so I'm interested to hear you say that. And it's certainly the way I approach many things. You know, there's a good or bad feeling about it one way or the other.
Yeah, so, very much so for myself as well.
Yeah, good to hear. That's really good to hear. I knew I liked you, Paul. So, statistically, so far you're doing well. Like we said, you've got a positive judgment or outcome on two of the, and you're waiting on the third of the case. So let's just rip into talking about the first trial. Of the three cases that you've worked on or took to trial in the last year or 12 months, there's one, the judgment is still under reserve, and that's the case of Hakopian Estate v. Mahmood. Now, I don't know anything about this case, so I'm going to let you take it away, and I'll interject with some questions now and then when I feel.
Absolutely. So this case was tried in Toronto in January of this year, January 2020, and it was before a judge alone, and it lasted about 2 weeks. Damages were settled ahead of time, and it was a case of a delayed diagnosis of cancer. And what had happened was the plaintiff was about 47 years old when she presented to her gynecologist with abnormal bleeding. She'd had abnormal bleeding for a while, and she had fibroids. The bleeding was such that she was having periods that were lasting up to 14 days, quite heavy at first. And when she saw the gynecologist, the defendant gynecologist, about 2 years before she ended up passing away, the gynecologist did an assessment. He recommended treatment, a uterine embolization, a uterine artery embolization. But he didn't do an endometrial biopsy. And an endometrial biopsy is a very simple procedure that a gynecologist can perform in the office. It takes a little scraping or sample of the endometrium and to be sent off for a laboratory analysis. And it can diagnose a bunch of things, including certain types of cancers. In this particular case, that wasn't done. So one of the issues was whether or not this gynecologist ought to have done that endometrial biopsy at that office visit. The lady goes on to have the embolization done, and she has some improvement in terms of her bleeding, and there's some shrinkage of the fibroid that was thought to be the cause of the abnormal bleeding. Fast forward about a year and a half or so later, she presents to hospital with shortness of breath. Ultimately, a CT scan is done of her lungs, which show what appear to be metastatic growth in her lungs. And from there, it all ends up being traced back to her uterus as a primary source of cancer. And she's ultimately diagnosed with what's called a leiomyosarcoma. A leiomyosarcoma is a very rare and aggressive cancer of the uterus, and is thought to or typically develop in or around leiomyomas, which are basically the same thing as a fibroid, which are benign. These types of cancers are notoriously hard to diagnose. And so one of the, what I'd say the big issue in this case, and we'll see how the court comes down on this particular point, but the big issue in the case wasn't so much whether or not this lady should have had an endometrial biopsy back when she presented with abnormal bleeding. The issue is, would it have diagnosed the leiomyosarcoma? Because the endometrial biopsies are very good at detecting certain types of cervical cancers. But the data suggests in the literature that they're not so good at detecting leiomyosarcoma. In fact, there was a range in the literature that the detection rate was somewhere between 30 and 70%. So you can imagine the defense argument, the defense theory, which was very well articulated by the other side, was it, look, even if this was done, it probably wouldn't have diagnosed the leiomyosarcoma for a number of reasons. One, we don't even know if it was present at the time she first presented. Even if it was present, it was probably, you know, smaller and harder to detect. And an endometrial sampling is a sampling of the endometrium, and this particular cancer was unlikely to have invaded through the endometrium because of the nature of the type of cancer that it was. So it was unlikely that a scraping or sampling of the endometrium would have generated enough cells to potential cancer cells to make the diagnosis.
Am I right to assume here that your theory was exually opposite of that, that endometriosis?
Yeah, of course. Okay. Of course, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a very simple theory, which, you know, when I do litigate these cases and bring them to trial, I do try to simplify things as much as possible, because I think that makes things easier for everyone. I would say sort of, you know, in my observation is the defense tends to try to complicate things and the plaintiff tends to try to simplify things. And our theory was very simple, that when she presented to the defendant's physician with the abnormal bleeding, that an endometrial biopsy should have been done. And had it been done, it likely would have detected the Lyell-Meyer sarcoma, which would have resulted in earlier intervention, likely a hysterectomy. We know that the staging of the cancers, of this particular cancer, if the cancer is found outside of the uterus and outside of the pelvis, that it's a stage four. So she had stage four when she was ultimately diagnosed. But if the cancer was contained to the uterus, it would have been a stage one. And our experts said that in all likelihood, had it been diagnosed 2 years earlier, it most likely would have been stage one. And the survival rates were much, much better for patients diagnosed at that early stage, particularly those who went on to have a hysterectomy and a complete removal of the tumor. So yeah, that was our theory of the case. And we had a couple of experts who testified on our behalf. We had a community gynecologist, Dr. Andrew Browning, he's from Barry. We also had Dr. Al Covens testify. He's from Sunnybrook, and he's the head of the gynecological oncology department at that hospital. And both of them, in my opinion, gave very convincing evidence that the likelihood is that probably it would have detected the cancer had it been done at the time. I mean, the reality is that, you know, on a standard of care level, it was a very difficult case for the defense. There really was no supportive evidence on behalf of the defense to say that this biopsy didn't need to be done. So we're left with a situation where probably the only thing that could have possibly detected this cancer was not performed. We knew that she had cancer at some point. And there's a very high likelihood, just from a common sense perspective, that that particular biopsy likely would have been beneficial to the patient and would have offered her an opportunity for life-saving intervention. So the optics, I'd say the optics of the case weren't very good for the defendant. And I think that may, if the case is successful, may be a contributing factor for a positive outcome for the plaintiff.
So thank you for sharing that. A couple of things that are really striking to me is your medicalese and the extent to which you can speak about this from the medical perspective is very impressive.
Thank you.
And I'm always surprised by that with lawyers who do practice medical malpractice law. What was the learning curve on this?
The learning curve?
Yeah, for the issues that you had to learn about.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I've been doing this for about 15 years, and I kind of think back to what I didn't know 15 years ago, and it probably could fill a few rooms.
Yeah.
And I you know, obviously have come to learn aspects of medicine from a very different perspective. I didn't study science or life sciences in university. I was a sociology major, and then I went on to law school. So science was never really my thing before getting into this area of law. One of the things that, you know, the way I look at it is medicine's like a big puzzle. And what I have the benefit of is individual pieces that I learned very, very well over the course of my career by consulting with physicians, doing medical research, trying cases. And in a way, everything kind of connects and makes sense. So as time goes on and you learn specific cases, it almost enhances your overall general knowledge, which then makes it easier to apply to new cases because you already have some kind of working foundation and understanding about how the medical system works and how the body works and what specialty areas deal with certain parts of human anatomy and specific medical issues and problems. So by the time I get to this particular case and try it in January of 2020, I'd already finished two trials. They're completely different areas of medicine, but you almost get the same kind of, you can almost reapply your knowledge to specific things. But I will say the learning curve was, you know, I think what I, you know, focused on a lot was there was a lot of medical literature on this particular type of cancer, which was very rare. And reading those journal articles can be dense and at times confusing. And until you get a basic level of understanding, it's almost impossible to understand it. One of the things that I really do like to do, and this has been a practice of mine throughout, is I really like to meet with my experts in person weeks before the trial starts. And I'll meet with them as many times as I can. And as you know, doctors have varying levels of patience when explaining things. But I do kind of force myself upon them and ask as many questions as I can. And I do it in a way where, you know, I put my ego aside and I accept the fact that, you know, I'm going to pronounce a medical term wrong. I'm not going to understand a particular issue, but I'm there to learn. And if I get corrected by the physician, the doctor who's my expert, I'm happy to have that happen. Because I'd rather have that happen before I go to trial than it happened during the trial. So I use them as a resource. And I think of these experts that I consult with as personal tutors. And they are some of the best in the country at what they do. And I have the benefit of learning directly from them. That I think is what really helps me get the knowledge that I need to represent my clients in a case like this and any other case.
Yeah. Well, it really speaks back to your comment that you think the best outcomes come from hard work and preparation. Because I can tell, you know, I know that area of the body quite well, and I can tell that you were well prepared and you have a good grasp. So because the name of this case is the Hacopian Estate, I'm assuming that this woman is deceased, am I correct?
She sadly died, I think it was just a couple days before she was to turn 50 years old. And she had been the sole caregiver to her mother who had dementia. And you know, after she passed, the mother had to go into long-term care, and there's a surviving brother who is ultimately the plaintiff in this case. And you know, it was a very large and heavy burden that was placed on him when his sister died, and having to deal with his mother because he lived out of the country. But she lasted, I think, about 3 months after her initial diagnosis. She didn't last long. You know, the cancer already spread into her lungs, and they did everything that they could. They did do a hysterectomy, and they did give her cancer treatment, but unfortunately, it was just too late.
So I understand from other lawyers that as far as medical malpractice cases go, the delayed diagnosis of cancer is a tricky one because of the many variables that could or could or should or shouldn't have happened. What was it about this case that convinced you to take it on?
You know, I took this case on relatively a long time ago. I think the case was opened in 2012. So one thing to note about a lot of these cases that end up going to trial, it can be 7, 8, 9 years before they go to trial. So, you know, what I knew about medical malpractice 8 years ago is a little bit different than what I know now. And I think what attracted me to this case was what I felt was a pretty glaring omission in terms of a failure to conduct a very simple and effective test that likely would have detected this cancer. So to me, there was a very clear marker in terms of where something went wrong and where things could have gone differently. Whereas in some delayed diagnosis of cancer cases, it's not so clear. The other thing is the time interval. So this is a case where it wasn't a 1 month delay or a 3 month delay. It was effectively almost a 2 year delay. Where you could make a very credible argument that the cancer had progressed between stage one all the way to stage four.
Right.
The challenge that we face representing plaintiffs in delayed diagnosis of cancer cases is that sometimes there's not a large appreciable difference between maybe, let's say, a stage one and stage two type of cancer, and all cancers are different. But sometimes there's not a large difference in terms of outcome for that level of change. And in some cases, the delay is very short, relatively speaking. Now, you know, most oncologists would say earlier is better. And, you know, any delay could contribute to a, you know, not as great good outcome. But, you know, when we're talking about a week or a month in certain cancers, it's really hard to pinpoint exactly what the harm was to the patient, particularly if you can't even prove that the staging would have been any different.
Right.
And so I think that's what, scares people off of doing these cases. And the other one is sometimes the outcome is bad either way. Yeah. And that was certainly the argument presented by the defense in this case, is that they said, you know, this lady was going to die anyway. Which, you know, in a way, you know, frankly irritated me that that argument was made.
Sure.
Because we're all going to die anyway, right? So you can come to court and say this lady was going to die. Sure, she was going to die. But would she have died when she died?
Right.
Would she have lived longer? Would she have had better quality of life before she
right.
died? And you know, as a matter of law, any kind of improvement that was curtailed by negligence, that can be measured in damages, and compensation should be given.
Sure.
But those are the two scare factors: are the fact that it's hard to prove that there was any damage
right.
because it either was insignificant or it would have been the same outcome anyway.
Right. Right. Well said. And are you free to talk about how the damages for this case were calculated or based?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure about the confidentiality of the amount, so I won't say, but,
sure.
I can talk certainly generally about how fatality cases are assessed in Canada. And surprisingly, they're not very high damages. The way that it works is if a family member of yours dies, you can claim for the loss of care, guidance, and companionship that you lost as a result of that person passing. But the awards are generally somewhat modest. Usually a case like this would be assessed, you know, in the couple to a few hundred thousand dollars type of range. There was an added element in this particular case of the fact that because of the daughter's death, the cost of care for the mother was transferred onto the brother.
Exactly.
So there was some economic losses there that were advanced. But generally speaking, fatality cases where there are no financial dependents. So it's different if, let's say, someone dies and they are the sole breadwinner for a family. Those cases, you know, can be worth a lot more money. But where there's no financial dependents, the cases are somewhat modest in terms of the damages.
Yes. So this is sad all the way around, this case. There must have been some really challenging days in the courtroom and or dealing with this family. When those days happen in the midst of a two-week trial, as this trial happened, I just know from my own experience in trials that there's, you know, the evening happens and there's 1,000 things to do, and then you have to be recovered or celebrated or whatever has to happen depending on what's happened that day, and prepped and ready to go the next morning. How do you deal with that roller coaster of emotions and level of work and fatigue that goes on in the midst of a two-week trial?
Yeah, so this particular case was extra challenging. I'm a single dad and I have three boys, and I had a childcare issue that happened in January where our nanny wasn't able to work. So there was a number of days in the trial where I had to get up and get the kids ready for school and feed them, make their lunches, take them to school, and then go to court.
Wow.
And then try to make arrangements for someone to watch them for a bit till I got home, and then I'd take care of them in the evening time.
Wow.
And that was probably about half the trial was under that type of schedule, which was an added layer of stress for sure.
Oh yeah, that's tough.
Although I enjoyed the time, like I enjoyed the break with the kids to kind of, you know, not think about court a little bit. But, you know, the way that I handle trials is, funnily enough, I try to get a lot of sleep. I often get up very early in the morning with thoughts racing through my mind about how I want to, how I sort of envision the day happening. And I certainly do a lot of projecting in terms of how I see myself interacting with the witnesses in the court.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm usually up very early, and I have these moments of, you know, ideas, and I sort of jot down these ideas on my phone or on a piece of paper while they're fresh in my mind. And then that kind of helps me deal with that particular day. I really do try to prepare the cases well in advance of the trial date. My target when I do a trial is to actually have the case 100% ready to go 1 week before the trial actually starts.
Mm. Good one.
I'm a believer that good ideas come from digesting thoughts and facts and opinions and evidence in the medical term. So I tell myself I need to have it all uploaded into my brain a week before the trial so that I can spend that week thinking higher level issues, strategy, and just feeling a sense of preparedness, which lets me sleep at night and get the rest that I need, because it is a lot of work and it is a lot of stress on my body and my mind to try these cases. And I think you need to be at 100% health going into it. You won't be at the end of it. You'll be exhausted, but you at least need to have that going into it.
Yeah. Well, good. Do you have like moments like in the shower or driving in the car or looking in the mirror? Are there moments where fresh ideas come to you?
They come to me at all times. It's kind of an obsession. Like, I don't know if this is healthy and, in terms of how lawyers have to, litigate cases, but it becomes something that you almost ruminate over.
Sure.
And you almost can't think of anything else. And I'm sure the people in my life get very sick of me being so focused on what I'm doing, but it does become an obsession while you're in it, because nothing else really matters while you're in it except winning.
Right.
And so you personally feel obviously responsible for the outcome. Obviously you can't control outcomes, but you want to feel like you're giving 110% to that client and to that case to increase the odds of a good outcome as much as possible. So there's a lot of pressure.
Sure. And, I have no doubt there's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, you're constantly thinking about it.
Sure, absolutely. And I think the plaintiff's lawyer position of, how and when you get paid from your work, there's the added financial concern for the family and for yourself or the client. Were there some high points in this trial and I guess some low points and surprises?
Yeah, in this particular case there was. So the defense lawyer did a very good job at trying to convince the judge that my experts couldn't comment on certain aspects of their opinion as they outlined it in their reports, basically saying that they weren't specific enough in terms of what their opinion was. And as you know, there's all kinds of rules in Ontario and other provinces about what should be in an expert report and the consequences for that not being in the report. And that consequence could be an exclusion on the part of the expert to give evidence that you hope or need them to give. So the trial got a little off its rails very quickly because these motions were being brought by the defense to effectively exclude critical aspects of the plaintiff's case from being presented in court. And that required argument. It created some scheduling delays. And it did create a genuine concern on my part that my experts may be curtailed in terms of what they can say, which would effectively be that would result in the case being lost. Fortunately, the judge dismissed the defense motions to curb the evidence. But during those 2 or 3 days that we were in it and fighting over it, I'd say that was a pretty low point. I was concerned. I was concerned that if the ruling didn't go in our favor, that it could have serious implications for the client. And it just would have been a crummy way to lose a case, to say that, the expert didn't specifically say why he thought that, the tumor was likely there 2 years prior. Therefore, he can't say that in his opinion, it likely would have been there because he wasn't specific enough about why that was the case.
Right.
And those sorts of arguments. So that was definitely a low point. I think most plaintiff lawyers feel that the hardest part of the case is putting your case in, right? Because we have the burden of proof. We have to prove the case. So the most stressful time is that first week or however long it takes for you to call all of your witnesses to give evidence. Once that's done, then you get your, first opportunity to be the cross-examiner and try to knock down the defense theory of the case. And, in my experience doing these cases, the defense can choose whoever expert they want to come and testify, but they don't have a lot of choice in terms of who their defendant is. And, I'll say generally that usually the worst witness in a medical malpractice trial in terms of, you know, how well they come across and so on and so forth, often it's the defendant physician. They're not a trained expert. They are probably, and, you know, I have empathy for this, but they're probably feeling under attack professionally.
Of course.
They're literally on trial, and they have just heard their colleagues, you know, because most of the time the defendant physicians are in the courtroom for most of the trial. They've heard colleagues of theirs come to court and testify and say how negligent they were.
Sure.
And that their negligence caused the woman to die. And so they have to sit through all this, and then they get their opportunity to take the stand, and they can go off script. I'm sure they're very well prepped and everything, but they can go off script.
Sure.
And not outperform very well. So usually the high point of a case, and in this case as well, for the plaintiff is the opportunity to cross-examine the defendant physician and demonstrate, you know, how the issues came about and why there was negligence. Because sometimes without hearing it from the defendant itself, you don't really know. And then you start getting a flavor of like, what went on here? Why did this happen?
Right.
So that in this case was a high point. And also, you know, I felt that the plaintiff was able to undermine some of the defense opinions. And so that was also good. So it felt like the case kind of picked up momentum, surprisingly, after we finished our case and got through, you know, presenting our evidence.
Sure. Well, I really appreciate what you said about the defendant physician, you know, feeling off balance, because certainly from my experience in healthcare, the talk is, you know, that's the worst day in health, the day you get sued and the day you have to go in court and defend. And but I'm also understanding your perspective that you know, that was your high point, probably that person's terrible low point, but your high point. So, any surprises in this trial?
You know, there weren't very many surprises. I will say, in my experience anyways, dealing with the counsel for the CNPA, is I've always had good experience in terms of, you know, preparing for trial with them, and being, you know, for the most part, pretty upfront about, you know, what they're planning to do. I mean, obviously you don't have to, you know, telegraph your strategy to your opposing lawyer, but certainly there weren't any, you know, moments where some document appeared that no one had seen before or some new theory of the case. I mean, we hear this happening sometimes at trial where there's a completely new theory of the case presented that no one had heard of, but no, nothing
TV
like that.
It
literally went as we thought it would go,
which
was good.
Well, now that it's over, and I know you're awaiting judgment, do you have a sense of whether or not you were successful?
I'm always optimistic. It felt right, if that makes sense.
But you never know. And how long do you expect? So this was just in January, and we're now early April. How long do you expect it will take to get a judgment?
You know, in my experience, it can sort of be between 3 and 6 months. There's a possibility that the judge may have some extra time on her hands, given the closure of the courts with COVID-19, that may expedite a written decision.
Right.
I would say I'm expecting it any day now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get, maybe it's in your inbox right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Who knows? So,
it's worth checking.
Yeah. Just hang on. I'll ask you just a couple more questions. I'm interested. I mean, stories like this strike to the very heart of so many people, women, patients, doctors, nurses, the general public, you know, missed or delayed diagnosis of anything that results in death is, you know, no thanks for any of us. The top 10 things you never, ever want to happen in your life. But I'm just wondering from your perspective, having gone through this process, the litigation of this case, meeting this family, meeting all the experts and the defendants, and now the trial, do you have something that you could share with us of value for each one of those audiences? For instance, for the lawyers listening, what was the most valuable thing that a lawyer could learn from the lessons brought forward in this trial?
You know, I think the lesson for the lawyers when it comes to trying a medical malpractice case is learning, putting in the time to learn the case inside and out. And you know, lawyers are constantly being pulled in a million directions. You know, busy personal injury lawyers, we have hundreds of emails come in every day, phone calls, and often the buck stops with the lawyer in terms of making decisions on from fairly minor issues to larger strategic decisions on maybe what could be hundreds of cases that that lawyer is working on at that time. And I think the most challenging thing to do as a lawyer is at some point, maybe 2 weeks before the trial starts, 3 weeks before the trial starts, accept that everything else is going to have to go on the back burner.
Right.
And you're not going to be doing anything except learning about, in this case, leiomyosarcomas.
Right.
So that you know them inside and out, and you know the issues in the case, and you read the expert reports over and over again, and you just spend that time. I think that's probably the most important lesson that I think any lawyer who's maybe doing a med mal trial for the first time is, you can never be too prepared.
Right, right.
But you can certainly be underprepared.
Yes, of course. And I didn't hear you mention any nurses involved in this case. Were there any nursing defendants?
No, not in this case.
And so how about for doctors, doctors listening in, what's the most valuable thing you think that a physician could take away from this case?
I mean,
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, looking at the early days, you know, the incident itself, that, you know, the first appointment where the endometrial sampling wasn't done, the early days afterwards when the questioning or management of the complaint or the concern, something that happened during the litigation or anything else in that mix that could be a valuable lesson for healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I'm always very careful and cognizant of is, you know, the courts are not the decider of, I mean, they are in a way, but they're not really the decider of what the standard of care is in the medical community. I mean, they're called upon to make those sorts of decisions.
Right.
But, you know, really it's, you know, a physician looking at the particular facts of this case, particularly a gynecologist, may have a gut reaction to the factual circumstances in terms of, you know, the sampling not being done, and may know immediately that that particular sampling should have been done, or it was okay for it not to be done, right? And that may just be their opinion and impression. I mean, I think, you know, any physician who's, you know, has been alleged of, you know, being incompetent or, you know, being below standard of care in terms of their treatment would benefit from just seeing how these cases unfold in terms of how they end up becoming, you know, lawsuits and then trials and then potentially judgments. But in terms of the specific factual, you know, issues in the case, you know, in this particular case, you know, what could I say? You know, you should do these samples when these, you know, women present to you. You know, it's hard for us to, you know, as a lawyer, for me to say that. I mean, I think, like I said, it's more about, you know, what can happen and how things can end up in court when something goes wrong, justifiably or not. I mean, that's what happened.
Right, right. The potential outcomes that, well, I mean, everybody lives in terror of, but doesn't always have a full understanding, which is one of the focuses of this entire podcast. I think I knew so little about medical malpractice, and having worked in obstetrics my whole life, and I really didn't understand this process and how adversarial it was, how difficult it was, and how important the day-to-day, you know, diligence of doing my job really well was until I got into this. I mean, I knew it, but I didn't really know it based on what potential outcomes looked like. So that's been a huge learning for me. And what about the public? I mean, you know, there's a lot of middle-aged women, and uterine or dysfunctional bleeding is a very, very common issue. Anything to offer up for the women in the audience who are listening to this and thinking, oh, gee,
I have always started to have a feeling when I started to practice in this area that you need to be an advocate for your own health and medical treatment. And that's not to say that you need to be a bother on the medical system and demand tests and demand this or that or the other thing, but certainly you have to realize that there is a possibility that a physician who's very busy may overlook something, may not review a test result as carefully as they should, may not order a test that should be done. Obviously, as a lay person, you may not fully recognize that. But certainly, I think anyone, any patient who has a concern that something isn't right and seeks medical attention and doesn't really get a good answer, I think it's not a bad thing to maybe get a second opinion or go back and just to satisfy yourself that you're, you know, getting the attention that you need, if you know what I mean. And I'm not to blame, I don't ever blame a patient for, you know, being told a particular thing and accepting it at face value. And I would never advocate to be arguing with your physician about, you know, their judgment, because that's not going to help you at all. But I think you need to come into your interactions with our medical system with a little bit of scrutiny in terms of where things can sometimes be overlooked, and be prepared to voice your concerns in a obviously polite Canadian way, but, you know, voice your concerns and get that attention that you think you might need that you didn't get. And I think that's 100% okay.
Right. Right. And, you know, I don't know, I might argue with it that it doesn't always have to be polite Canadian. It just has to happen in a way that's effective to getting results, you know.
Well, exactly. Exactly. 100%. And I think we know how to do that. We know how to be assertive. And right. I think sometimes you do have to assert yourself in the medical system.
Sure.
Otherwise, you might get overlooked.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting, Paul, because this is podcast number 7 or 8, I think, that I've recorded in the last couple of months. And the word advocacy, self-advocacy, advocacy for your clients, doctors and nurses advocating for their patients has been a very, very common theme throughout. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a great takeaway from this today, the advocacy point of for yourself, for your own health, and for the people in your life, but then you as a lawyer and doctors and nurses also advocating for excellent care within the system. So I think that's a really good place to stop on this one. We've got a couple more cases that we're going to talk about, but is there anything else you want to add before we wrap up this, our discussion on this case?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered everything.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, just to recap, I'm here today with Paul Cahill, and the spelling on that name is C-A-H-I-L-L. He's a plaintiff's lawyer from the firm of Will Davidson in Toronto. If you'd like to reach him, he's easy to find through his website, and you can watch that handy-dandy 90-second video about Meet Paul Cahill before you call him up so you know what he looks like, what he sounds like. But thank you very much, Paul, and we'll be back to talk about some more.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Chris.